very good to have Peter Selby, Bishop of Worcester, here to speak on globalisation post-September the 11th. Before he does, just to remind you that, as with all the seminars, this one's being recorded, so if you've got a mobile phone that's likely to make a loud noise, can you make sure it's switched off? And also to remind you that these tapes and CDs are for sale in Jesus Christ Superstores, so do go along if there are any talks, including this one. This afternoon, this one shall be available. And if they're sold out, there are forms that you can order them with. So I'll hand over to you, Peter.
Thank you. Well, I'm delighted that you've come, and rather surprised. There are even people here who know me, and that's even more surprising. Before I start my own presentation, can I just say that I have been ordered to say that the petition against war in Iraq is still up for signature in the peace zone. I think they're up to 1,200, so if you all haven't signed, that would make a good extra number. So I was told to tell you that, and I do so with great pleasure. I've been asked to talk about globalization, and what I really want to do is to leave plenty of time for questions and discussion, and to raise the question in advance of that as to what globalization we're talking about. There are very, very strong opponents of globalization. There are people who speak against it at every opportunity, who want us to return to a more localized world, where things are smaller, where the goods we eat, consume, wear, don't travel so far, where therefore we don't use as much energy, where therefore we conserve the world's resources better. And I entirely understand why people say that. I'm not terribly clear that it's a very real possibility. And I'm also not terribly clear that it's a totally desirable possibility. And for this reason, I fundamentally believe that globalization is a divine project, a divine imperative. Now, of course, as soon as I say that, you are right to wonder whether I really mean that I'm in favor of world capitalist domination and whether I think that's a divine project. And the answer to that is no, I don't. But I need to raise the question in that sharp way, so that we talk about what globalization we actually mean. The one we have, the one we could have, the one that God would have us have, the one that our politicians need us to have. What is the globalization that we're talking about? We could be talking about the globalization of money. We could, post September the 11th, be talking about the globalization of rage. The globalization of rage. That's, I think, the context in which we live. We could be talking about the globalization of affection and interest. One of the things that those of you who take any interest in the history of Christian missions must be aware of is the extent to which globalization arises really from a series of accidents. People became Christians and they then got posted somewhere else, on ships or as soldiers, or because they met somebody somewhere and decided to marry them. that's causing a dynamic of change which has gone on since roughly 35 of the Common Era. So we are dealing with a process which reflects, in my view, the divine dynamic. And it's not surprising that the divine dynamic is at risk of being corrupted by processes that are fundamentally sinful. It's not surprising that globalization embraces a whole variety of different kinds of phenomena. Let's start with money. I got interested in the international financial situation because at a certain time it was announced that we could no longer afford to give our children a higher education and we needed them to borrow to have it. I imagine there are a considerable number of debtors of that kind in this room, in this tent. And that caused me to reflect as to what actually lay behind this statement that we could no longer afford to give people a higher education and they'd have to borrow in order to have it. I noticed that we can afford a whole lot of other things, so I wasn't quite clear why we couldn't afford that. And my mind went back to my own student days. My mind went back to what difficult and rebellious generation we were. My mind went back to the French student revolts of 1968. And I asked myself the question, what could be done to make sure that couldn't happen again? And I thought, I bet I know a really good idea. Give all these students a debt and then they'll behave. And accordingly, that's what's been done. And we now have a system of higher education in which people have, as I've said in my book on the subject, two educations for the price of one. They may learn physics or French or philosophy or sociology, but they also learn debtordom. They learn how we are expected to live. And we are expected to live by constantly borrowing from the future in order to live in the present. And by the time they finish their higher education, they will be co-opted into another system of debt, which is called mortgage. And those systems are highly profitable. They're highly profitable to people who have money, and the way you have money is basically by printing it. Let me say what I mean. We have a banking system which is called fractional reserve banking, which means that for every pound that a bank may have on deposit, it can lend out a substantial multiple of that number of pounds. And the reason for that is that they reckon, usually rightly, that we aren't all going to want to draw our money out on the same day. So they don't need to have as much as people have actually lent them. And so money goes around the world in search of a home. A profitable and immediate home is what money seeks. And that, in our situation, and particularly in the last, shall we say, 40 years, has radically transformed the world. It's transformed the world to the point that most of our existing institutions are no longer equal to the task which faces them. If you read, for example, the account which conservative ministers give, and I trust conservative ministers, of course, implicitly, if you read the account they give of what it was like to be in government when Britain was expelled from the exchange rate mechanism, you do not have the feeling that you're hearing people with much authority. More like people living in a bunker hearing about substantial troop losses all over the place. And the reality is that for all we may debate the issues of money and sovereignty, the reality is that no nation now can defend its own currency. Because what is happening is that as money seeks its most profitable home, people move it around. And they move it around in vast quantities. And now, because of technological advance and the whole computer revolution, they move it around very, very fast. And as the amount of money in circulation and the speed of circulation increase together, so what actually governs our lives is that fantastically fast, fantastically huge movement of world resources. And bear in mind what I said earlier, which is that all that money actually represents debt. It is a mountain of debt, a mountain that is built up not of rock and firm foundations, but it's built on the sands of confidence. It is essentially a confidence trick. Now, of course, sometimes it goes badly wrong. And when it goes badly wrong, people suck their teeth and they say, gosh, we really must do something about it, because if people bring the system into disrepute, somebody might change the system. But actually, what is wrong is something at the heart of it. And unless the international community can begin the process of taking some control over this substance, which we're all invited to trust, if that doesn't happen, what will happen instead is this substantial increase of amount and volatility, which is causing a huge amount of distress to the poorest people. Because the thing that makes money your enemy is if you don't have it. And what I've noticed is that, international affairs apart, more and more people in our society are becoming more and more anxious about the system in which they have been urged to place their trust. They've become more and more anxious about their own future. They've become more and more anxious about whether the nest egg — that's rather cuddly and pleasant metaphor for what is actually something resting on a dangerous mountain of confidence, which is shifting all the time. Into that situation, we have this other globalization intruding itself. And that is the globalization of rage. Essentially, what I have been describing is something over which people sense themselves to have almost no control. And in the absence of having any control over that, what happens is the explosion of violence and rage. And the story of the world before and since September the 11th, before and since that iconic action took place, the story of that world is the story of people seeking the means to globalize their rage. And they need to do that, from their point of view, I stress, they need to do that, because if they are content with their rage being localized, nobody will take any notice. And the transformation of huge tranches of the world's population into people who have nothing to lose is, I think, the most dangerous phenomenon of our time. So the globalization of money leads to the globalization of rage. Behind almost all the significant uprisings of war and terrorism among the poorest people of the world lies their powerlessness in the face of the globalization of money. All this could be an extremely gloomy picture. And it leads many people to write books and tracts against the whole globalization process. And yet we just do need to stop and pause and think about the creative implications of all the things that come under the heading of globalization. It started, I guess, with the cheap transistor radio, with the cheap telephone, with the cheap transmission of information along microscopic cables around the world. It means that it is no longer possible to keep from poor people indefinitely the actual character of their situation. It means that it is no longer possible for rich people to excuse themselves with the statement that they did not know. It means, and this is also important, it means that human beings can be in touch with one another across thousands of miles instantly and can foster relationships and relatedness which can, if rightly promoted, offer a counterbalance to the globalizations of money and rage about which I've been speaking. So dismissing globalization as a totally bad thing is not an option either. Nor is it an option for a more profound and religious reason. It is surely becoming clear that we are globalized also in other respects of our living. We are globalized in our consumption. What we take out of the ground, a substance, say, as basic as water, finds its way into changing the environment of people at a great distance from ourselves. Our pollution is global. It doesn't respect frontiers or tribes or communities. So there is a globalization of the demand for resources and of the infection of the world with pollution of various kinds. And that globalization is related to the globalizations of money and of rage. For if it is the case that the movements of money based on debt are dominating our lives, what that does is to cause, not just to depend on, but to cause the increasing consumerism and increasing demand for resources. And what that does is to act with no respect towards the environment that you and I inhabit. An environment treated repeatedly as though it were a credit card, one with no credit limit and no repayment date. And that globalization, the globalization of pollution and demand for resources, in turn feeds in to the globalization of rage among people who find themselves living with the consequences of the globalized and uncontrolled, dominated economies of the north of the world, the Western Hemisphere, call it what you will. What is to be done? Well, first of all, these idols of money and growth need to be named. I suppose I got into this matter somewhat by chance some 5 or 6 years ago. And I approach it from various angles in various situations. But I have to tell you that I have not found a single subject which so keys into people's personal lives as much as this. Nor have I found any subject about which people have said they find their church life, if they belong to a church, less engaged. I didn't know, said one person to me, that it was bad to be poor until I started going to church. That's a serious indictment. And it's a serious indictment that a church should continually talk about money only when it needs it, and not about the effect of money on the lives of people who attend. For the reality is that we are part of that globalization project, potentially. We are charged, and I think that means all believers are charged and all persons of goodwill are charged with shifting the character of this globalization so that it accords more closely with that globalization which is God's project. And that has to do with words like justice and love. And the evidence is that people can reinvent the character of money so that it becomes something more like an instrument of exchange and something less like an instrument of domination. This book that has just appeared, called 7 Steps to Justice, speaks about the remaking of money. It comes from a body known as the Christian Council for Monetary Justice, which sees in the perversion of the character of money the key to the corruption of the globalization we have. It means looking again at reducing money to its proper status, the status of an instrument of exchange, the status of something that represents real goods and real services. It means disciplining the process by which money is created by private institutions so that they can make more of it. It means, to quote the title of another book, it means rethinking globalization. It means harnessing for the purposes of development. It means harnessing the divine globalization energy to counter the polluting, demanding, dominating energy of the globalization we have. It means accepting that the power of human sin will corrupt the processes of globalization so that they become polluting and dominating. And the origins of the Jubilee legislation in the Old Testament, the origins of that legislation lie in the enormous wisdom of our forebears who could see that any economic system has within it the seeds of its own corruption if you don't regularly interrupt it. and the Jubilee idea, which has had such a powerful impact in the world over recent decades, and especially since the Jubilee 2000 campaign. The Jubilee idea is a fundamental piece of human wisdom that says economics are to be subject to human beings' gentle and loving control. They are not to be instruments of domination. We've got actually to help people out of the delusion that by borrowing more and more from our future, we can secure our present, when in fact all we do is make our present more dangerous. Later today, in another seminar, I put on another of the hats that I wear as Bishop to Prisons. And I don't want to trespass into that now, except to say this. The future of an undisciplined globalization is, and we are seeing it before our eyes, the steady locking up of more and more people. I sometimes foresee a time when we shall be one-to-one, those who lock people up and those who are locked up. Because what happens under an undisciplined and money-dominated globalization is that people are put into the positions of powerlessness which lead to the globalization of rage. And for those who are not possessed of the instruments of violence on the grand scale, they are bound to resort to the institutions of violence and criminality on the small scale. And saying these things is not by way of excuse. It is by way of the assuming of responsibility by all of us for processes in which we all actually play a part. I think what has happened to the character of globalization over the last two or three decades is a wake-up call to all of us to embrace the divine globalization that is based on justice, affection, and humane networking, to base it on that and to take issue with all those things which lead to a globalization that is corrupt, polluting, and dominating of the poor. It's over to you.
Peter, thank you for speaking with such clarity. I'm sure it will have stimulated a lot of questions among us. We've set up two microphones on either side. If there are people on that side of the tent who have questions, if you'd like to form a queue by that microphone, and those on this side by this, then we can take them alternately. So if you have a question, don't be shy. Come forward.
Hi, can I ask about interest? Some have argued that the root of this expansion of credit and so on that you've talked about is the institution of interest, and whether usury or indeed interest at all. Can you say a bit about where you stand on that and what you think we can do about it?
The first thing that I want to say about that is that I think that interest ought to be one of the foremost agenda items for interfaith conversation. And that might seem a rather odd reply, because I think in a way I'm being asked to make an economic comment about whether I'm in favour of interest or not. But the story of interest is a hugely interesting one. As many of you will know, Muslim people have a history of a ferocious opposition to the institutions of interest. And one of the most interesting features of our world is the extent to which Muslim nations and Muslim people have decided to opt out and create their own banking systems. And the principal objection they have to interest is that the creditor is entitled to interest without taking any risk in relation to the project for which they're lending the money. And therefore, the power rests always with the lender. Now, of course, if you lend enough and you've borrowed enough, the power thing can shift because most institutions don't want to have massive bad debts. But if you actually look at the relationship between interest and the relationship between Christianity and Judaism, well, I don't need to say end that sentence, do I? It's a terrifying story. You've only to just think about the Merchant of Venice and what all that history was about. It is a matter of profound interfaith importance, and that I do want to say that. Secondly, I mean, it is becoming clear that we are gradually discovering that we cannot afford to live in a world in which huge rates of interest predominate. But unfortunately, many of our poorest people still suffer from usurious rates of interest. I was talking more specifically about debt at this event last year, and I made the proposal then, and I still think it would be a sensible proposal, to deal with the issue of interest rates and of usury, not by the criminal law, not by punishing people for charging too much interest, but by a very simple thing, which is to say that if you charge more than such and such a rate of interest, which would have to be determined, you will not have recourse to the civil courts for the recovery of your debt. I frankly do not see why we as the community, as taxpayers, should provide the means whereby people exploit other people. And there are steps which can be taken to discipline the whole business of lending money at interest. The whole international... I'm sorry, I'll not talk much longer, but the whole international debt crisis revealed, I think, that there was a real question about whether the banking institutions which were owed all this money actually really wanted it paid back. Anybody who's had any experience of debt counselling, of helping people to find out how much they owe and what it would take to pay it off, will know that actually most lending institutions don't want the money back. All they want is a guarantee that they will get it back. They'd much rather you went on borrowing it and paying the interest. And the reason for that's quite simple. If you pay the money back, they've got the bother of finding somebody else to lend it to. So I do believe that interest, as we practice it, is a very corrupting and dangerous institution, and it's certainly one of the things that needs to be addressed. And for the reasons I've said, I think the faith communities have a particular responsibility to do that.
You were talking earlier about the Jubilee in the Old Testament. I think most people would agree that the Jews never kept that part of it. Would you like to comment about that and how that affects your subject?
Well, first of all, most people don't agree. It's a very controversial question whether the Jubilee was observed or not. And when you read the controversy, I usually find it tells you more about the political attitudes of the theologians in question than it does about what actually took place. All I want to say about it is that the Jubilee legislation contains very substantial warnings against attempting to circumvent the Jubilee. You know, don't say to yourself, it's only a year till the Jubilee, I better not lend this money. You know, because if you do, the Lord will judge you for hardening your heart in that way. Now, I don't think you provide rules to stop people avoiding something that never happens. I therefore believe it probably did happen, and certainly most people were compelled to live as though they thought it might. And that's quite a good idea.
Peter, can we have a question from this side?
A family with, I don't know how many tens of thousands of student debt. Any practical suggestions that, what can we do, or those that are not yet into that situation?
I think that the trouble always is with this sort of thing, is that it takes a massive accumulation of individual misery before people begin to connect the dots of individual misery and make a picture around the subject in question. I actually think that more and more people are aware that a society in which all the 22-year-olds are absolutely burdened with debt is a society in which there are huge risks about the kind of future we shall have. Huge risks to people's mental health, huge risks to their family, and huge risks to this pack of cards we call the housing market, which is one of the ways in which misery will certainly reveal itself. And I think that our job is to start people talking to each other and joining up the dots, and start to nail false statements like, we can't afford to do it any other way. The reality is we have chosen to do it this way. That's the reality, not that we couldn't afford to do it any other way. So the issue is about joining up the dots, about helping individuals to become a movement. And only then, I think, will people begin to realize what we're doing to a generation. And I think they are beginning to realize. I mean, there are all sorts of signs that people who swore by this system are now beginning to realize what it does. I think there's another thing I think we must actually do. If people are educated as debtors, which they are, we have to provide means for the undoing of that education. I still believe that it is wrong for people to live on the basis of indebtedness, and I don't say that in personal judgment of individual people who make the only choices available to them at particular points. But I do think undoing this education, changing the behaviour patterns which it encourages, is something we have a responsibility to do. Because otherwise, the habits which are learned between 18 and 21 will become the habits of a lifetime, and more people will be under this undischargeable burden.
Could we take this question, which is on the same subject?
Sorry, I was sort of pipped to the post there. As well as wanting to know about what to do about student debt, and is there anything that we can practically do to help students, and obviously I'm a parent in that situation too, you made a link between student debt and social control. Do you think that was intentional or not, or could you enlarge on that point?
Well, on almost all subjects, isn't there? There's a debate between the conspiracy and cock-up theories of history. I suspect in this case it's a rather artificial debate, because while I don't believe, probably, probably, I don't believe, there was a meeting at which people sat down and said, if we created a massive student debt mountain, they'd all behave. I suspect that human beings don't work like that. What happens is the steady corruption of patterns of thought, which go through phases like those horrible layabouts who spend all their time on demonstrations at my expense, that kind of Daily Express view of the world, leads by various stages through the political process to a decision not to make it possible for them to do that. Leads to the encouragement of a vocabulary about education as an investment, most peculiar idea. A peculiar idea because I think people should do the menial things that have to be done in society in order that they can spend their time educating themselves, being educated, enjoying the huge and wonderful traditions of human wisdom. And I think it is about naming this problem, and it is about stopping people getting co-opted into that spirituality, that way of thinking. I mean, I tell this story. Many of you will know one of the most, in my opinion, remarkable theological minds in our country, John Hull. And John Hull has written a lot about the spirituality of money. And I came upon a particularly good purple passage in this book about money, which was about how the younger generation think. And I marched into the kitchen and I started reading this out to assembled members of my family who thought I'd gone slightly mad. And when I finished, there was a pause, and I hadn't asked myself how would other people react. And my daughter, who was in her late teens at that point, said in a very serious voice, "I don't know anybody of my friends and in my generation who hasn't been co-opted into that way of thinking." And I think it is now a steady task of demonstrating to people that there is a world of exchange, a world of gift, which is not a world of credit and debt, and which, yes, may mean that you have to wait a bit longer for something or other, but which actually is a better world.
It's in my mind that it was Thomas Aquinas who legitimized debts in the Christian world in the West. Could you lead me to any philosophical, theological schools that are exploring what seems to be the interconnected points of debt, environmental destruction, global injustice, and addressing things such as the International Civil Society, which I've heard for the first time this weekend? So really just a few names from you because philosophy is going to precede change. I'd like to know what religious thinking is going on in this sphere. And also, what can we learn from our Sikh and our Muslim neighbours? Because aspects of their life, they don't borrow. They actually work as families and groups. And what can we learn from them?
Well, we can learn that. There are many of these questions that you're asking about, which I'm sure there are other people here who know more than I do. But I want to say something here which might not be the answer you're expecting, but it's something about the character of the church and why the church's ideas change. And in particular, I would like, if I may, with respect, gently to challenge your concluding statement that philosophy precedes change. You see, one of the things about student debt, the previous question, is that by changing people's behavior, you change their attitudes. I've written about this in Grace and Mortgage, that the research shows quite conclusively that many students go to university believing it's wrong to get into debt and determined to avoid it. They find it's impossible. And because they find it's impossible, they come to the conclusion that it's not wrong after all. And the reason for that is quite simple. Nobody can go through life believing that something they have to do is wrong. So they change their attitudes. And it is actually behavior that precedes attitudes and not the other way around. And that's the reason for keeping Lent. It's the reason for all those strange religious disciplines that all religions have. It's because it's because when you move your body in certain ways, it changes your brain and changes the way you think. And that's why we have to change our behavior about this subject. And then we will change our ideas because, you see, the reason why the church, which had been against usury for all those centuries, the reason it changed was because it had members who were saying, excuse me, but I can't run my business unless I'm allowed to do this. And in the end, the church, I mean, it happens with things we approve of and things we disapprove of. The church responds to the needs of its members. The church's views on all sorts of things will change as and when significant proportions of its members come out into the open and say, excuse me, but we're here. And that's what happened over debt. And what now needs to happen is a reversal of that, that the people who are impoverished by it also need to come out and say, excuse us, but we're here. You've let this system, which was created to let some of our members make a living, is actually doing something awful to the rest of us. That's what's got to happen, and then we'll change.
Bishop Peter, my question's a slightly different slant, really. I was thinking yesterday, listening to Tom Sine, about how we present an image of what it means to be community. And I wonder what the implications are in what you were saying for being church, for our worship, for our discipleship, for our teaching. Because it seems to me that if we don't have a way of envisioning what it means to be this kind of community where relationship is giftedness and where there's a sense of exchange and where we explore what really matters to us in terms of our values and the things we hold to be of deep value to us, and there's no space to explore that, then, you know, what hope is there really? And I think it's a question really about how you see the implications for being church. Big question, I know.
I mean, it's a big question, but also absolutely proper question. And it's a especially proper question to anybody who parades himself in front of other people as having some authority in that strange organization. First of all, the things that I've talked about have got to be named. It is really intolerable to me, I mean deeply intolerable and offensive, that people should be able to say accurately of a church that they only talk about money when they need it. That's a very serious matter, because, I mean, I have talked at a major diocesan conference about these subjects, and at the end of the conference, within a few minutes, four people had come up to me in turn and said that they went through bankruptcy and the one place they knew they couldn't talk about their experience was church. Now, that's a very, very serious matter, because we talk about very deep things in church, but we somehow walk around that. And I speak against myself. I mean, as you can tell from my age, I mean, I grew up theologically a lot in the 60s and 70s. When we used to go on various kinds of workshops at which we talked about and thought we were being deeply honest about all sorts of things we were feeling and who we were feeling them for and so on. And we didn't dare talk about what we earned or what we had. So naming it is very, very important. And that will allow people to come out into the open. And for example, one diocese where I worked at this on... As their Millennium Project employed a debt advice worker in one of their estates. So there are things we can actually do. I also wanted just to say a little bit about the church and money, because I keep saying I keep saying, you know, we only talk about when we need it. I've got to be careful because I actually see faces that I know here from my own patch. I go around saying we need money. I don't say this to get any great credit, but just to give you an example of what I mean. Many, many churches have gone around saying that their church could run very well if only people gave a half tithe. And they pull this figure of 5% out of the air, and they ask people to do that. My point is, that's a very self-serving image. It has no, well, first of all, it has no scriptural background. Who ever heard of a half tithe? Who ever heard of a half Christian? Right? But secondly, it neglects the opportunity that our own needs have to enable us to serve other people. If we said to people, we think you should tithe, and we'd be glad if you felt that what we were up to was sufficiently worthwhile that you'd give us half of it. And then you'll find you've got half a tithe to do an incredible amount of good in the community, to do an incredible amount of good for the world. And we would then be raising money in a gospel way, because it would actually be for the people who are not our members. We wouldn't be kind of trying to raise the money for our own electricity bill as an organization without attending to the clamant needs out there. That's just an example. There are many others in which you can give a twist to our domestic programs in such a way that they serve the world and raise the issues.
Thank you. Hi. A couple of things. Are you able to suggest any practical, creative ways which we can further the global divine project that you described? I'm wondering if there are things like the globalization of resistance that has been going on a little bit, and thinking of things like the Zapatista movement in Mexico and the way they've used the internet. So that's the first question. And also, could you repeat the names of the books and the authors that you mentioned as well?
The second part of the question is easy. I'll do that. I'll do that first. I mentioned seven steps to justice, which is about various things that need to be done about money. Basic incomes, common ownership, proper deal for women, solution to issues around the money issues around the Middle East and Kashmir. Jointly authored Rodney Shakespeare, Peter Challen. Forward by Peter Selby, but it's quite short and doesn't ruin it. Publisher. Publisher is... New European Publications. If you anybody wants ISBN, you know, come and get it off me. Now, rethinking globalization is extremely important because it's produced by somebody who could have been co-opted into the tiger economies of Southeast Asia and decided not to. And his name's Martin Kaur, K-H-O-R. I think he was here last time, actually. I'm not sure. Anyway, that's a very important, very, very important publication. And I'm trying to see the name of the firm that published it. And I'm not managing that. Because it was published by a joint coalition of NGOs. Zed Books, Z-E-D. Okay. This is much more a polite book because it was published by the General Synod of the Church of England. And it's called Development Matters, Christian Perspectives on Globalization, and it's published by Church House Publishing, and it's edited by Charles Reed. And there are some good essays in it. This book is called Debt and Delusion, and it's by Peter Warburton And it really takes to bits some of the follies of much orthodox economic thinking. He's an economist and a Christian, and that is published by Alan Lane and Penguin. And I suppose I should mention. Two other things. I mean, David Jenkins wrote a famous book called Human Market Whys and Human Wherefores, which is Castles. Peter Selby wrote a book called Grace and Mortgage. That's now fairly out of date, but it's still available, so I mention it. What was the other thing? Globalizing networks. I don't know how to answer that question except to say it seems to me that it's happening. And it's happening by some of the people who are sitting in this tent. It's happening by some of the things that are going on in neighboring tents. We are actually beginning to discover that the people who invented globalization to make money and thought that's what what it would do are going to have to learn that it also is a tool for the asking of these kinds of questions. I mean, all the networking that goes on, all the extraordinary, the amount of travel that goes on, mean that we can no longer expect, and people who want to rip us off can no longer expect, that we shall stay local and ignorant.
There are those that say that Christians should stand in opposition to the international finance and trade institutions such as the WTO and the IMF. What is your position on that? Because there are those who say that we should work with them towards towards humanising globalisation and towards a globalisation of public goods. Should Christians be working with the international and finance trade organisations, or should we be looking at a sort of the globalised resistance people who are standing in diametric opposition to them? And what's your sort of slant on that?
I mean, I think your question is a particular case of a general problem, isn't it? To what extent do you go along with the system in the hope of changing it, and to what extent do you stand in sharp resistance? And, I think we need a St. Paul's theology of the differences of gifts here, because, in fact, if there are not significant numbers of people standing in vigorous opposition, the cooperators will become colluders. And on the other hand, if there are no people trying to get into conversation with the people who are running the system as it is, how will we ever learn what it is that needs to be changed and what in it actually might be for our good? And so I give a kind of fence-sitting answer to that question, which is only what you would have expected.
Thank you.
Peter, you haven't sat on the fence at all, and we do thank you very much for leading us through that. The next event in here is